Hello, welcome to A Night of Sin. We look at how composers from Kurt Weill to Soweto Kinch have explored the seven, or in one case as eight, most deadly temptations. And Hilary Mantel on winning a prize for books most people don't know she's written, and the experience of becoming the most hated woman in Britain because of a royal remark.
I don't feel that I had anything to add to my original speech, my essay, and I certainly have nothing to apologise for.
More later from Hilary Mantel on her latest award and what she really said about the Duchess of Cambridge. We start tonight with a change of career for one of Britain's most successful writers. William Boyd has won prizes including the Whitbread, Costa and Sunday Express Awards for a list of novels including A Good Man in Africa, Any Human Heart and Restless, many of which he has also adapted for TV or film. But now, at the age of 61, he's making what he admits to being a frustratingly belated debut as a stage playwright, although with a piece that is also a literary adaptation. Longing, which opened last night, is adapted from two stories by Anton Chekhov, My Life and A Visit to Friends, one of which was the basis for Chekhov's own play, The Cherry Orchard. Boyd's play amounts in effect to an additional Chekhov drama, in which Kolya, a successful lawyer, makes a visit to the crumbling, near-bankrupt estate of old friends, whose summer guests include Varia, a doctor who, like him, remains unmarried in middle age.
Why aren't you married, Kolya?
What? Me? Why aren't you?
I'm a dried-out old doctor who works in a factory hospital and smokes too much. You'd have me.
Lots of men.
Then where are they? You, no excuse. Good-looking, successful, a Moscow lawyer. You must be fighting the women off.
Well, that's... I don't know.
Tamsin Gregg's Varia with Ian Glen as Kolya in William Boyd's Chekhovian drama Longing, which opened at London's Hampstead Theatre last night in a production directed by Nina Rain. With me is the critic Peter Kemp, chief fiction reviewer for the Sunday Times. Peter, so William Boyd has flourished on the page. Does he seem at home on the stage?
I think by and large he does. I mean, he does something very ingenious. As you say, he's taken his inspiration from two stories by Chekhov. And what he's done basically is to combine the mood, storyline and emotional curve of one story, A Visit to Friends, with sociological details that he's taken from the other, A Visit. And the first story gives him a picture of a doomed class and its elegant but feckless way of life, this sort of refined little world that's financially upon its uppers. And the other story supplies the coarser-grained characters, the upwardly mobile, ruthless peasants who are displacing this class. Where I thought the play was at its best, and when it was at its best, it was terrifically good, helped by a superb production, I thought, and a really beautiful atmospheric set. Where it's at its best, I think, is when it's dealing with the doomed class, the bankrupt gentlefolk. It's really good at giving you this sense of charming desperation. They've invited back an old family friend who they've not seen for well over a decade, and basically they want to get him to save them by marrying into the family. That's so impressively done.
Set by Lizzie Clacken, who in fact we praised for her set for Port, the Simon Stevens play of the Nationals. They want to watch in two senses there, I think. I found I had to make a mental adjustment because I was thinking, really interesting to see what William Boyd can do on stage. And it feels like a lost Chekhov play rather than a fresh William Boyd. He's almost absent in the way that an adapter or translator would be.
I think so as well. Where he has sort of altered things a bit, I think it works less well. I mean, the first part of the play is tremendous. It does feel like a very good Chekhov play. I mean, you've got a very familiar sort of Chekhov setting. You've got the country estate, the silver birches, the samovar on the veranda and so on. You've got this refined little world that's facing destruction. That's all done very well. And it's helped, of course, by tremendously good acting. I mean, we've just heard the two best performances in a very well-cast play.
Brilliant.
Tamsin Gregg and Ian. Yeah. They are brilliant. Yeah. I mean, Tamsin Gregg is witty, sardonic, she's ruefully realistic and stoical, and she very affectingly conveys a sense of this unfulfilled relationship that may have existed between her and the lawyer when they were younger. And Ian Glen is matchingly good. I mean, he's presented as someone who's very attracted by the beauty of the estate and its way of life, but he shies away from any kind of emotional or indeed financial commitment. Where it's not so good, I think, is in the portrayal portrayal of the peasants. I felt that was often caricatured, this like screeching vixen-like daughter of the oafish peasant on the make. That seemed to me to be very much kind of overdone. And also, I thought there was some comedy brought in, like fisticuffs that were flailing around, and it was not great. But basically, I thought this was a terrific display of the way that different kinds of longing, sort of emotional, sexual, social, material, all play their part in Chekhov's imagination.
I agree with almost all of them. My conclusion at the end was that Nina Rain should go and direct Chekhov play and William Boyd should write a William Boyd play.
And Tamsin, Greg and Ian Glenn should appear in a production of The Three Sisters as soon as possible. Really.
Directed by Nina Rain, I think so.
Indeed,
thank you to Peter Kemp. Longing continues at the Hampstead Theatre in London until April the 6th. Now, do you happen at the moment to be feeling angry, greedy, proud, lustful, slothful, envious or gluttonous? If so, the next item may be useful, although you would have to fight your sloth and delay your lust to go on listening. The seven deadly sins have been invoked ever since sermons and writings in the early Christian church as a terrible warning against temptation. David Fincher's thriller Seven features a serial killer acting out each weakness. And many musicians have also been tempted to dramatise them, from Kurt Weill in the 1930s to the British saxophonist and rapper Soweto Kinch, whose new album and stage show, The Legend of Mike Smith, follows a young musician through the seven traditional invitations to misbehave. So front row listened to sins being sung, beginning to the possible envy of the other contributors and his own potential pride, with Soweto Kinch, a.k.a. Mike Smith.
It came about for a number of different reasons, but one conversation that kept recurring through musician friends around the world is the idea of perhaps dark, murky forces running the music industry and corrupting the listenership and artists alike. So I kind of wanted to investigate that and also consider, just from a personal level, what is it like to be possessed by a spirit of greed? You know, what is it that's special about these individual sins and what makes each distinct in a performance context as well?
Hey, when will I be getting mine? I ain't getting left behind. Every minute, second chimes. I don't get no second time. Ain't saying I'm jealous, but they got the chain and necklace shine. When will I be getting mine? When will I be getting mine? When will
I be... The German conductor André de Ridder has just conducted a concert version of The Seven Deadly Sins written by Kurt Weill in 1933 with his regular contributor, the playwright Bertolt Brecht.
For us, learning it at school, you know, in the 80s, 90s, it's an important lesson in Germany that, you know, you have to take a stance and rise up against things that are happening.
And Seven Deadly Sins is very unusual in form, or relatively unusual. It's in French, a ballet chanté. So you have, it doesn't include one of the elements, you have song, you have dance, you have drama as well. So it's very complex in that way.
Will she now, will our Anna pull herself together?
I guess you could call that a... We call it a Vorreiter, like a precursor of music theatre. You know, he basically pre-echoed what musical theatre would be in America and what he then ended up doing. In fact, you know, that's what musical theatre is, isn't it? The combination of dance, of songs and of chant.
Soweto Kinch's version echoes Weill's by giving the central character a split personality, played by Soweto and his brother, Toyin Amari Kinch.
We're twin aspects, my brother and I, of the same personality, which is partly autobiographical and also fictional.
But your side of it, it is Fausty. I mean, you're quite a tempting, teasing figure at times.
And there's moments of the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde quality as well, where a spirit, if you like, takes over the way that I perform. So I mean, internal thought processes on the one hand, but also a kind of frenzied sound of him being full of lust or being... full of sloth. The only dialogue that we have between these competing sides of his brain is on the first one of these sins, Acedia, for all you Latin speakers.
Which is sloth.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to get up and exercise, and his legs are literally in my persona saying, well, what are you doing that for? Just sit down and have a burger and chips.
Come on, dude, behave!
What's making you so brave, Lucas? Hey, you ain't used to brain. Use your brain. Me and you the same.
I'm going to train, mate.
Okay, great. But who cares if we gain weight? How much difference does one day make?
I said I'm going to train.
Blood. You only stay the same shape. You only overstrain. Swollen veins make your shoulders ache till your ankles joint, then your bones sprained.
In 1998, as part of a series of projects exploring the music of Brecht and Weill, The singer Marianne Faithfull recorded Seven Deadly Sins and has continued to perform the piece.
I first heard it 25 years ago. Hal Wilner played it to me, and I've been working on it ever since. And my great ambition was to do the full production, which I just did in Linz at the opera there. We did it with the ballet, with sets, costumes, the orchestra.
So my sister and I left Louisiana.
Singers get inside songs. They have to, in a way that we can never as an audience. So what is it you found as a singer inside those Brecht vile songs?
Well, I think it's the most wonderful piece. I really do. I think it's been ahead of its time originally, and I think it's almost still ahead of its time. It's just extraordinary. The music is absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I feel very strongly about Brecht's lyrics. I still agree with him. I love the way he turns the seven deadly sins on their head. The sins, the vice becomes virtue and the virtue vice. I find that very interesting.
I was going to say exactly that. That is a fascinating thing because virtually every other version of it until very recently has been a warning against the sins. And that's what makes this adaptation of the legend so different.
Well, the main thing about Brecht is that he was in, it's a very, very anti-religious piece. And I'm very anti-religious myself. You know, so of course it's not straightforward. It's not about vice and virtue in the sense that that the religion could understand. No. So lust becomes love and pride becomes pride in your work. It's all different. Mm. Yeah.
There are two Annas. Now, people have different versions. They could be two versions of the same woman. They could be sisters and so on. Do you have a view on that?
They're two aspects of one thing, but they're both separate people. But, yeah, I mean, without the dancer, it's not as good, but it's still wonderful. If it's a real performance like we were doing in Linz, there really is Anna 1, which is my character, and there really is Anna 2, which was the dancer.
Our mom and dad and both our brothers wait in old Louisiana, and we'll send them all the money as we make it. For all the money's got to go to build a little house down by the Mississippi in Louisiana. Right, Anna? Yes.
We're never quite sure, and Weil himself acknowledged the ambiguity of the storyline. I mean, we're introduced to two people, and when it's staged with two people, it becomes obvious that it seems to be two sisters, but it could also be one person, almost schizophrenic person, in dialogue with herself. The only place where we wonder is where evidently Anna 1, the singing voice, seems to have actually taken away, nicked Anna 2's boyfriend and gone off with him. So then you start thinking, I mean, that either she's really crazy or it is actually two different people.
In most versions of The Seven Deadly Sins, from Kurt Weill to Soweto Kinch, audiences can guess how many major songs there'll be. But when Paul Heaton, a former member of the House Martins and the Beautiful South, explored the legendary Temptations for a solo project, he went, as it were, one worse. As the title, The Eight, indicates, Heaton added another.
I chose to sort of build the story along the fact that there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then there was this mysterious eighth that we never knew existed.
Finally penny drops, the eighth was just the cops. That man had devised a cunning plan. Take the ravenous lip paw, a mix with the unsure. then make them think the other works for the man.
And at the time, understandably, you held back what the eighth sin was, but were at enough distance to talk about it. That's very prophetic with the phone hacking scandal and all the various scandals and controversies that surround social media. But you were onto that, even at that stage, that it is. It's one of the governing passions, the drives of our age, gossip.
Yeah, it is. I mean... I think one of the great things about the seven deadly sins, and if I may add my eighth gossip to the eighth, is they're all quite easily transposed to modern day society.
And lust is, I suppose, the one that most of us think we understand, and it's the one that has kind of the clearest sense. So how did you approach that one?
Lust, I don't know if lust is such an important one to the basis of the my piece of work, the eighth. It's another one, but I feel the real crux of my story was between greed and gossip. But I chose to talk about lust in the terms of how lust was punished by the eighth. And in fact, my setting for lust was a same-sex couple in a car who had been approached by the eighth, which is gossip, and told that the other person in the relationship was also working outside that relationship and was having an affair both with the police and with another man. And so lust was turned on its head immediately by the eighth sin, gossip, and was told that if this is how you behave in lust, you will always be defeated by the eighth sin of gossip.
Unless the audience for a performance of any version of the Seven Deadly Sins happens to contain a large number of saints or hermits, listeners will inevitably start to tot up which sins they've committed or would like to commit again. So did the musicians find themselves examining their consciences?
I sort of associate sin with religion, and my mum and dad weren't very religious. My mum particularly was from a religious background. She was from a Christadelphian background, but had rejected it and was keen for me to live as she saw fit and I saw fit. So there was no big warning signs.
I'm not controlled by the seven deadly sins any more than anyone else. Obviously, the most deadly one, I suppose, for all of us is pride as a great sin. That causes a lot of trouble. But I just don't see it like that. I mean, I've been working on this for 25 years now. I see the seven deadly sins as Brecht sees them. I know what you're saying, and I know what I'm meant to say. Oh, lust, you know, but it's bullshit. I don't believe that.
No, you weren't meant to say, oh, lust. I left it entirely open to you.
Oh,
there are many.
Well, anyway,
yeah,
they're all very, very serious, I think, in a way. But I see it as Brecht sees it.
Which is that they are potentially virtues.
They can be seen like that, you know. I don't really know, man. I'm not an expert on sin. I do know a lot about Brecht and Weil, but personally, obviously I keep my nose clean and do my work.
It's hard really to pick any one, because I tried to immerse myself deeply in each vice and obviously make an immense leap of character outside. But I think a lot of it's autobiographical. A lot of it is my own personal journey into it as well, and my take on lust or envy. And they're interesting for different reasons. Envy, for example, it's so ubiquitous, status envy and anxiety about our position in the world. And it's also the only vice that nobody really wants to admit to having. We don't like to own up to feeling slightly jealous of somebody who's got more than us. So each one had its own nuances and brought things out of me as a writer and performer.
So Weto Kinch's The Legend of Mike Smith is available as a recording now and will be staged at the Birmingham Repertory Theatre in September. Marianne Faithfull's Seven Deadly Sins and Paul Heaton's The Eighth are available on CD. Andre de Ridder's Seven Deadly Sins will be broadcast on BBC Radio 3 on April the 16th. This and previous editions of Front Row are available as downloads through the BBC Radio 4 website. One of my duties outside of the studio is chairing a panel of nine judges who decide the David Cohen Prize for Literature, a £40,000 prize given every 2 years to a British author for outstanding achievement across a career. The previous winners range from V.S. Naipaul in 1993 to Julian Barnes in 2011. In choosing this year's winner, the judges faced a dilemma when Hilary Mantel emerged as a leading contender. Some grumpy pundits have complained that the author of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies has already had too many authorial awards, having won the Man Booker Prize twice and the Costa Book Award in recent years. But the judges concluded that this honour looks beyond Mantell's Thomas Cromwell trilogy and acknowledges more than a dozen books over three decades, including the comic novel Flood, the tragic story A Change of Climate, the tragic comedy Beyond Black, and the devastating memoir Giving Up the Ghost. The message of this award, I suggested to Hilary Mantel after last night's presentation, is bring up the body of work.
Yes, it is, when you think about it, quite a diverse body of work. And I think that has been one of the difficulties for me in building a readership, is that I change my act between books. And the readership attracted to one subject or setting might not move with you to the next. But you've got to follow the curve of your own development as a writer and not be pushed off it by marketing considerations. It is a long game, as this prize shows.
And something that has now happened to two successive winners of the David Kern Prize, it's something about our culture thing. I think Julian Barnes, the previous winner, he wrote a scholarly essay about sex for Radio 3. It was reprinted in the Radio Times. And suddenly every newspaper, he's become Britain's Mr. Sex, as if he's some kind of sexologist rather than novelist. Yes. You had a similar thing you wrote for people who have read the proper, the full essay, and I'd urge them to do so. You wrote a considered and thoughtful and indeed rather tender and kind essay about Kay Middleton, as she used to be, the Duchess of Cambridge. And then it was traduced by various newspapers that you'd attacked her. Was that a shock to you that that happened?
Oh, no, I have a very low estimate of the tabloid press and human nature in general. So I couldn't say it was a shock, but it is a pity. And it is rather ridiculous. As you say, it was an article sympathetic to the royal family. It was turned into its opposite, and for a week I had the distinction of being the most unpopular woman in Great Britain, I think. I was eased out of my top slot by that poor lady in Tewkesbury who had 11 children and wanted a bigger house to put them in. But the popular press is always looking for a hate figure, and very often it's a woman.
I hope you didn't read much of it, but it got very nasty and personal at some points, which is another thing that you have to deal with.
Oh, yes. I mean, you have a few thumping bullies leading gangs of drooling inadequates who find their home online, sheltering behind anonymity. The national conversation is debased, but we know that. I'm not the only victim of this. It was Mary Beard a couple of weeks ago. And I think if you venture to speak in a public forum at all, it's something you simply have to toughen up, you have to put up with it. I don't feel that I had anything to add to my original speech, my essay, and I certainly have nothing to apologise for.
And one of the pleasures of the David Kern Prize is that you get to nominate the winner of the Clarissa Luard Award, which is to encourage young writers. So we're going to talk to your choice in a moment as well, but tell us about your choice.
My choice is Katie Ward, who has written a brilliant first novel called Girl Reading, which was published to considerable acclaim both here and in the United States. But I know how hard it is to get yourself a public and get yourself a living at this stage. And the second novel is crucial.
And Katie, again, it's an unusual prize. It's because you might know that your publishers were entering you for the Costa or whatever or other prizes. But this one, I mean, it comes out of nowhere. So in a way, that gives it a particular pleasure, I think.
I take it as huge encouragement, really, and I think encouragement is very important for new writers and new work. And I obviously feel extremely grateful to Hilary for everything that she's done, not just this evening, but supporting me really from the very, very beginning.
It's very neat, this, because really the David Kern Prize is about a career, and a lot of people will be surprised. You said in your acceptance speech that they think you... some people think Wolf Hall was your first book. I mean, quite a lot of people think that was his first one they read. I think I read them all as they came out, in fact. But it's an important thing to remember this. 30 years ago, you were Katie. I mean, you are writers at different ends of a career.
Yes, that's quite true. I was 35 when I published, a bit older than Katie. I had been writing for 12 years. And sometimes it's necessary to do that. I laboured away in silence and obscurity, if you like. You know, there's a lot of luck involved in whether you get published, and a lot of people give you a hand up in those early years. And without being pious, I do think it's a writer's duty to put something back. You know, the odd thing is that Katie and I hardly know each other. We have met on the page. And that is where I think in the years ahead, readers will meet Katie and be blessed in so doing.
And Katie, did you have 12 years scribbling in quiet solitude? Is girl reading, is it your first attempt at a novel?
No, it's not. I do have another whole manuscript that may yet go in the recycle bin. I first was introduced to Hillary, having had my first manuscript turned down by many, many, many agents. And I came to terms with the idea that this manuscript would never, ever see publication. And Hillary gave me some very thoughtful feedback on it. And I happened to say to Hillary in an email, I have this idea for a book about women readers and paintings. And Hillary just was straight back, oh, yes, that was an excellent idea. Publishers will go for it. And that was a real, they say tipping point, don't they? It was an important moment.
And the David Cohen Prize and the Clarissa Luard, they celebrate literary progression in different ways. One is long progression, one is the beginning. So the dreaded progress question, and pretty much you've been writing acceptance speeches for the last 6 months, pretty much. But I know we talked about this before in our previous interviews. You're desperate to get back to fiction, but it's been delayed again, has it, presumably, by this?
What's happening at the moment is that Bring Up the Bodies is coming out in several European countries. I have been putting a lot of work into publicity, and you must put some work in, you must put some effort behind your book. In a sense, I'm tired of hearing myself talking about writing. The new book, the third one in the Cromwell trilogy, is full of challenges, and it's by no means a simple continuation of what went before. It's a radically different kind of book, or at least so it seems at the minute. And every day, you know, every writing day is fresh. Even if you've just received a Lifetime's Achievement Award, there's no assurance that you'll be able to do it when you wake up tomorrow. So every day is a new challenge.
And Katie, on the progress question, so where am you're on with number two now, are you?
Yes, I've been working on this novel for a couple of years. There was a lot of research, partly because there hasn't been much written about the subject and I had to go back to primary sources.
So it's not about the Tudors. Hillary can relax, you know.
I can tell you now it's not about the Tudors.
Finally, Hillary, I can now reveal the next prize that you're up for. I have in front of me Glamour magazine and in the April edition. You are on the shortlist for the Glamour magazine Woman Writer of the Year. Your competitors are Caitlin Moran, Claire Balding, Dawn French, E.L. James, J.K. Rowling, Maeve Binchy, and Miranda Hart.
I hope glamour isn't a requirement. Otherwise, I shall have to ask, have they actually seen me?
Hilary Mantel, winner of the David Cohen Prize for Literature 2013, and Katie Ward, winner of the Clarissa Luard Prize. Mantel, incidentally, is also eligible for the Women's Prize for Fiction, previously the Orange Prize. The shortlist is announced next week. I'll be back on Monday with guests including Stephanie Mayer, creator of the Twilight series, at 7:15.